Good morning, everyone. The Mary Griffith Show is underway, powered by Refreshment Services Pepsi's Harvest Ridge Coffee, and I'm powered by Harvest Ridge Coffee each and every morning, so that's why I'm so perky, even when I don't really want to be perky. I'm caffeine-infused, thanks to the Pepsi Cola Company and Refreshment Services Pepsi. Catherine Bakke-Mekas joins us today to talk about the Community Foundation, and today we're going to talk about just the wide range of services that the Community Foundation gives, and we'll talk about charitable planning, ways to start a fund, how to use your IRA for good. I mean, a lot of people are now mandatory taking of IRA gifts, and they don't want to pay tax on it, so it might be a way to make a donation to your favorite charity. So, Catherine, welcome.
Thank you, Mary. Glad to be here.
Well, we're going to talk today about all things Community Foundation. I had an interesting conversation the other day. A lady said, well, after I die, all my money's going to the Community Foundation. I said, oh, and what you know, have you picked, or how is that good? She goes, oh, I haven't decided any of that yet. I thought, do they even know that you're planning on doing this? I said, you might want to call them.
we appreciate it, yes. No, there is, I don't have the statistic, you know, at the top of my head here, but there is a shocking statistic out there that shows the number of planned gifts that might be coming in the future that an organization, a nonprofit, knows about is just a minuscule amount of the ones that are, you know, potentially floating around out there. Very few people take that step to actually inform the nonprofit that that they've got a gift planned in the future. You know, either way, they're greatly appreciated.
Absolutely. I remember when I was more involved as a board member of Quincy Community Theater, much to our surprise, we got a bequest from someone's will. Very pleasant to receive that. And I think in a way it was good. In a way it was kind of good we didn't know, because you never want to count your chickens before they're hatched. But also, when you're saying to your friends, oh, I'm going to give my money to, make sure there's a mechanism in place for that really to happen. Because if you don't have a will, or if you don't have like your IRA going to the Community Foundation, or your, you know, life insurance policy going to the Community Foundation, it will not go. It's those documents are very specific, and you can have all the intention in the world, but you have to put that in writing.
Yes, and there's, you know, there's really, there can be two parts to it. So yes, most importantly, designate it however you're going to plan that gift. Work with your advisors, whether it's you know, a part of your estate through your will, or the residue of it, whether it's, yes, your life, the beneficiary of a life insurance policy, whatever that might be. Of course, you need to document that appropriately so that it actually makes it to the Community Foundation. That's step one. Step two, if you have something in mind that you would like us to do with that gift, or whatever the nonprofit is that you would like to actually use that for, you know, set up a time to go talk to them, because that is one thing we do quite frequently, is sit down with somebody who says, you know, I don't necessarily have the ability to create that fund now, but here's in the future what I would like it to do. So we can put together a simple intent to have on file, so that if and when that gift ultimately does make it to us, we've got that paperwork there that says, Mary wanted this to help the animals, or wanted this only spent in Brown County, or whatever that specific purpose for that gift is. It's much easier when we've got it on file, because we can just get that set up very, very quickly and efficiently.
And you don't have to necessarily set up your own fund within the foundation. You can contribute to a fund that already has your goals. There's Quincy Community Theater has a fund, and the YMCA has a fund, and there almost isn't any charity around here that doesn't already have a fund. So it's a very simple way to give, but you have to educate yourself a little bit. And this is why working with your financial planner and with your legal advisor on your will is so very, very important. Charitable planning, and that's what it is. It is planning. Talk about the different ways to give, because when people see the gift of grain, that's not something I'm going to be doing. My little bushel that I grow on my backyard porch is not going to make much difference. But there are so many different ways to give. And in your little brochure here, you have about 7 or 8 different kinds of ways. And I think a lot of people would be surprised. They haven't even thought about this.
Yes. So there, you know, when we're talking about planned giving, I guess let's give a quick definition here. So there are many, many different ways to give to a nonprofit organization. And I think most frequently people think about just, you know, writing a check. Cash, you know, a gift that goes now and is used now. That's probably the most common type. However, when we talk about a planned gift, that is any type of gift that is arranged now, arranged in the present, but will actually happen in the future. And that future could be next week, or that future could be, you know, after your passing. It really depends on the goal and the asset. But yes, you know, oftentimes when people think about planned giving, the first thing we might think about is just listing a nonprofit organization in your will. So that's a gift that's not going to cost you anything during your life. Oftentimes people, you know, aren't sure what end of life costs are going to be. So you might be a little nervous to give a major gift during your lifetime, because what if you or one of your children need that money, you know, at some point?
And I think that's a very legitimate concern, and doesn't mean you can't be charitable. Just means that charity is at the bottom of that list.
Sure.
But it's still there.
Yeah. So, you know, some folks might approach it kind of, if they have a charity that they really deeply care about or a cause they want to impact, they might include that charity as, you know, essentially one of their children. So if they've got two kids, maybe they want to, you know, split it three ways between those two kids in the nonprofit organization, or the remainder or residue after all those distributions are made to family and other things. Some folks might choose to say whatever's left over after these things happen, send this to my favorite nonprofit to do X, Y, and Z. So that's kind of one of the most common ways people think about planned giving, but it is certainly not all through a will. You know, like you mentioned, a gift of real estate or a gift of grain or other tangible property would be classified as a planned gift. And I love this. We actually have a fund at the Community Foundation, and I love this because it's a fund for agricultural education, and it has been funded through gifts of grain. How appropriate is that? You know, the establishing gift was made through grain, and the family has continued to grow that fund through gifts of grain. And I always want to give the caveat that please do not unload a, you know, bushel of grain on the parking lot of the Community Foundation. But how it works is essentially at the elevator, the donor has it sold in the community, transferred and sold in the Community Foundation's name, which is tax advantageous for the farmer, and of course beneficial for the nonprofit.
Very tax advantageous for the farmer. And that's the other thing. You know, most of us think, well, I don't have much, so I don't think I have to worry too much about consulting a lawyer or a financial advisor. However, you know, you may want to, for example, this is kind of a little weirdo pet peeve of mine. Life insurance transfers tax-free. So people who leave their life insurance policy to their church, it might have been better to leave the life insurance policy to your kid and leave your stock, part of your stock portfolio, to the church, because the kid's going to have to pay a lot of tax on the stock portfolio, but won't have to pay anything on the life insurance. Now, you know, again, you have to be a little bit sophisticated to know this, but a little bit of education on your part can save that what you really wanted to go to is your heirs and your charity. Mm-hmm. And putting that in the right amounts can maximize that and keep Uncle Sam out of your last days.
Yes, yes. Always important to work with your financial advisors, your attorneys, your tax planners to, you know, take stock of what assets you have and, yes, what are going to be the most advantageous ones to pass to your kids directly, and what's going to make sense to reach your charitable goals. Because, yes, it can get very confusing, and there's a lot of different rules and, you know, tax, you know, implications of different types of assets. So you're right. We always, you know, when we're talking to a donor who wants to establish a fund, we always want to ask, okay, what type of asset are you planning to use it? Because sometimes, you know, they might describe, oh, I'm just going to cash out a stock and then send it to you. Oh, no. Give that directly to us.
Give
the stock directly. Don't liquidate it first and then give us the cash. You know, make that gift directly to the Community Foundation.
And that means that the Community Foundation doesn't pay tax on it, and you don't pay tax
right
on it. This is a hard concept, but Like, let's say you bought a stock of XYZ Corporation 20 years ago, and you've held it, and you've bought other shares, but you basically held it, and it's paid dividends. You bought it for a buck a share, you know. When you go to sell that at $7 a share, you have to pay capital gains tax on that $6 increase. Mm-hmm. But if I give that to the Community Foundation, I give them the whole $7 value, I have no tax burden. And yes, you know, I'm out. However, I've got other money to replace that. I may have savings in a savings account. Well, I'm, you know, I can't do anything with that. That's why it's so critically important when you do a planned gift that you really think about, where are all of my assets? How do I want them to be dispersed? And, you know, of course, your family will always take a major role in what we want to leave our legacy. But if you leave just 5%, and that may be one stock option that you have, that may be, you know, a mutual fund mm-hmm. portfolio that you own. One of those, just one of those things given to the Community Foundation spares your heirs from the stock from having to pay taxes on it and gives you a great charitable deduction and lets your legacy live on. So there's awful lots mm-hmm. of ways. IRAs is another thing. You know, IRA, a lot of us have them, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're clogging along pretty good, and then all of a sudden you have to take your minimum disbursement. And people say, well, if that's the biggest problem you have is somebody trying to throw money at you, you don't have too many problems. But you have to pay tax on
that. That's right.
And so all of a sudden you think you're, oh, well, my IRA, when I start, you know, when I turn a certain age, I'm going to get $5,000 a year for my IRA. No, you're not. You're going to get $5,000 minus all the taxes.
Right.
But let's say I'm already giving to my church. I'm already making an annual contribution to a charity. I'm already giving to the foundation. I give them that IRA. They get the whole $5,000. I have no tax.
Right, right. The IRA is a really popular vehicle amongst our donors, increasingly so over the past several years. So, yes, individuals who are 70 and a half or older can give up to $100,000 per individual or $200,000 per couple if you're in a household together to your favorite charity or charities tax-free. And again, how that works is you don't want to take the distribution first and then give it to the charity. You want to have that given directly to the Community Foundation or to whatever nonprofit you wish to support. So you'll just want to, you know, talk to your administrator and work with them on having that done. But oh my gosh, yes, a very popular vehicle for individuals who are eligible for it.
Yeah. So you can give through your IRA, through a life insurance policy, through grain or other property, real estate. Again, you bought that apartment building for relatively nothing. And now 80 years later, what is its assessed value? You know, do you want your children to have that burden? Donated securities, stocks, and of course, good old fashioned cash.
Yeah.
They still take cash.
Always.
That's a wonderful, wonderful way to give. We're going to take a break. When we come back, our conversation with Catherine Bakke-Meckes continues on The Mary Griffith Show. We're back. Talk Radio 930 WTAD. We have Catherine Bakke-Meckes on once a month to talk about the Community Foundation. And the advice she is giving today is good for not just the Community Foundation, but for any charity that you want to support. There are so many ways to give to a charity. And one of the reasons the Community Foundation is encouraging philanthropy is because if all of us, and that means somebody who has very, very, very little in assets, you know, and somebody who has quite a lot in assets, if everybody would just give 5% to their community, it wouldn't matter if that 5% was $100 or $50. It wouldn't matter if that 5% was $1 million. Our community would have that money then in perpetuity to use for the good and future of our community. And most of us love our hometowns, and that's why West Central Illinois and Northeast Missouri are lucky, because they have these opportunities to have a community foundation where they can put their money where they know it will continually do good. We've talked a little bit about using your IRA for good. Remember that when you get to the max, to the minimum required distribution, which is 70 and a half, you can directly avoid paying income tax on that by giving it directly to the foundation. You can give up to $100,000 a year from a traditional or Roth IRA, and you just do that by a direct out. You don't want to ever touch the money. You don't want to ever have it come into your bank account or anything like that. The impact that it can have on your community is extreme. The tax burden it can take off of you is absolutely fantastic. And, of course, you have to take that required minimum distribution anyway. So if you don't need it to live on, why take $5,000, pay $2,000 of it in taxes to Uncle Sam, and then have $3,000 when you could have $5,000 in the hands of a charity? No, nobody's suggesting you starve to death or not use your money for your own needs. But there are some people who this year, if it's a minimum distribution, I don't need that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so deciding to give. Catherine, I'm going to give you only just about 5 minutes
sure.
for this. But how do you decide what to give and how to give? And as you say, most of these decisions are made with, we never know when we're going to die, and we don't know how much money it's going to take to sustain our lifestyle until we die. So you really are kind of in the dark. But it doesn't matter if at the end of your process you have $1 in that bucket or you have $1 million in that bucket. At least you've made a plan for where how those buckets are going to be filled up.
Yes, and this is where we really encourage folks who are thinking about giving and thinking about creating planned gifts to bring us in the conversation while you're doing that, because you know, while your professional advisor's role is to help with the technical execution of those gifts and make sure that you're following and getting the maximum tax benefits, your community foundation can help you maximize the impact of that gift and set up an endowment, or perhaps give to an endowment that's already there, that's going to you know, express your values, that's going to reach your personal goals. And we can get really creative when we're creating a fund, because most people have more than one thing that they care about. Perhaps I really care about my community. I really care about kids. I really care about this specific nonprofit. We can get creative and create an endowment that's going to express those goals in multiple ways versus just a single stream. So perhaps we create a fund that half of the distribution goes to, you mentioned, the Quincy Community Theater, and half of it goes to the Humane Society. You know, it's a hard to pick. I love both of these. Well, we can impact both of them with one single fund if we want to do that. So just some really creative ways to do that with one gift that comes in, and different ways that people might not have thought about. We have all kinds of stories, all kinds of examples from community members, neighbors just like you, who have created some really impactful funds through us.
I know one thing that a lot of people are getting married later in life, or it's their second marriage. It's like, we don't need a toaster, but we know people are going to want to give us something. Make a gift to the community foundation in honor of the married couple or something like that. You know, again, I mean, Greg and I said, do not give us any gifts, but we knew people were going to, because mm-hmm. that's just what people are not going to come to your wedding and not give you a gift. So we're like, food, gift cards, or Greg was like, Home Depot.
Right? Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you know,
always
I mean, Home Depot, Lowe's, Menards, and Mary's like, food. So anyway, Catherine, it's been delightful. Thank you so much for what you do. Quickly, how can people contact you if they're starting to think, hey, you know what? I think I don't have any money, but I've got a house, and I've got, you know, a life insurance policy, and, you know, gee whiz, I've got an IRA. I guess I'm not quite as poor as I thought I was. Maybe, you know, I ought to make a plan for 5%.
Yep. You can always give us a call, 217-222-1237. Always happy to chat. Or just if you want to do some perusing, some information to begin with, our website's www.mycommunityfoundation.org.
Okay. Do it, folks. It will enrich your life. We're going to talk Cardinal baseball in just a moment. We're back, Talk Radio 930 WTAD. On the phone with me from the St. Louis area is Ed Wheatley, the president of the St. Louis Browns Historical Society and Fan Club. He's got leadership positions at the Greater St. Louis Amateur Baseball Hall of Fame and the St. Louis Sports Hall of Fame, and has written and done great research, Emmy Award nominated producer, does a lot of things with baseball, and he has written a book called The St. Louis Cardinals, Everything You Need to Know. And Ed Wheatley, welcome to the Mary Griffith Show.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
The only thing I have a problem with the book is it's awfully thin for everything I need to know about Cardinal baseball. But it's a nice read.
Well, it is. I mean, people are amazed how much is in that book. But we did it on purpose that way. You know, there's a lot of big, thick books out there that go on and on about the Cardinals. This is kind of patterned after during the golden years of baseball, those books that came out in the late 50s and early 60s that people like myself and all my peers and so many people as young people growing up, you could just dig in and grab these nuggets. And it's also, it turns out, seniors are loving it as well because these are their memories as well. But the important thing is to know Cardinal history, the second greatest franchise in the major leagues next to the Yankees. You know, they've won the second most world championships, their history where they dominated the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, not so much the 50s, three times in the 60s or in the World Series, and then the 80s, and, you know, we know what's happened here in the 2000s. But young kids just don't know the history. And, you know, I have spoken on different topics of baseball in many different school districts this year, over 4,000 kids, and it's amazing how many people don't even know who Stan Musial is.
Yeah, just think about it. There are children that are born today, and they won't know. I mean, they'll start loving Cardinal baseball, and they won't know that Yadier Molina, you know, was the catcher.
Right.
I think of playing catch with my little godson, and he wanted to be Yadi so bad. I mean, that was all he wanted to do. Yeah, grow up to be Yadier Molina. And now that he's a young man in his own career, Yadi has gone and will never be forgotten by those who knew him. But you're right. There's always a fresh group of great Cardinals coming up, and that's what keeps the game so vibrant and keeps us interested year after year. But we want to look back and remember the Stan the Mans and Mike Shannon, who has a special tie here to Quincy. I know we just lost Mike, and he had a home here in Quincy. His second wife was from the Quincy Hannibal area. Our thoughts go out to Lori as she mourns the loss of Mike. It was a great guy. Part of this, the thing I like about
speak of that, yeah, Mike Shannon just lived up the street from me when I grew up. You know, these guys are regular Joes. I had Dal Maxwell, Ray Washburn, Don Dennis. You know, from those '60s teams, they were just living in my neighborhood. You know,
well, part of the reason they were living in your neighborhood, they didn't make any damn money.
Right? Other people made just as much money as some of these ball players. But these guys got to play every day. They got to cross that magical white line.
Yeah, Mike was talking to my husband and I one time, and he said, you know, when he was playing professional baseball in the early years, you know, they were hard-pressed sometimes. And now, you know, as a Cardinal announcer and a Cardinal legacy, I mean, he didn't brag about it, but he's like, you know, now that I'm not playing anymore, I make more money than I ever did, you know, playing for the St. Louis Cardinals. Yeah.
People don't remember how these players, how, you know, they weren't paid that much. I remember in 1971, the minimum major league salary when I came out of high school was $14,500. Now it's, you know, almost $700,000. I mean, that's how much it's changed. And I always tell people, you know, as they see the FedEx, UPS, Amazon Prime trucks driving all over. Back in the 40s and the 50s, they didn't have all these rounds of playoffs. Two teams made the World Series, and if you didn't, you know, you didn't get any extra money. A lot of these guys went and became drivers for the big department stores like Famous Bar, Macy's, Sticks Baron Filler, which became Dillard's, or Scruggs Vandevert. Can you imagine? And I got the story firsthand from Enos Slaughter that all of them, you know, they would divvy on who's going to work where. Now, can you imagine opening your door for some delivery, and there's Enos Slaughter, great Hall of Famer. You know, the big guys like Stan, he owned a restaurant and a bowling alley, and some of them worked at car dealerships because they would bring in fans just to look at cars and maybe buy some. But, you know, you'd go in there to see a baseball star like Mike Shannon and that.
Yeah, the car dealership, the beer dealerships, you know, anybody that could take that baseball legacy and, you know, gravitas and turn it into something that was point of sale. These baseball players were able to make extra money early on doing things like that. Well, let's talk a little bit about some. I just opened it up, for example. Now, here's a name I remember, but, you know, I don't remember that much about him. Fernando Tatis. I remember
that
name.
Yes.
But
well, and you're hearing it again because his son, you know, plays for the Padres and, you know, is one of their big stars.
Now, you mentioned on page 15 of the book, Everything You Need to Know About the St. Louis Cardinals, that a record was set April 23rd, 1999, in a game against the Dodgers. I wish I'd have known this the other day when I had a good Dodgers fan on. Fernando Tatis hit two grand slams in the same inning off the same pitcher. So basically the Dodgers had given up and they were just going to leave the guy in. And that is
it wasn't late in the game either that he did it, you know. It was in the third inning. So it was like it was like, what were they thinking? Well, you know, he hits a grand slam, they leave, you know, Chan-Ho Park was their one of the big aces, stars of the Dodgers, and he threw that pitch and he got in trouble, and you know, Tatis hit the first grand slam, and he kept pitching, and men kept getting on base, and here comes Fernando, and you know, maybe he just thought, what are the odds of him, you know, getting another one? But for the only time ever in baseball, they're in Dodger Stadium, two grand slams.
Two grand slams
will always be carved.
Eight RBIs, and you say that record will probably likely never be broken. But isn't part of the fun of baseball is that all the records we think will never be broken, they usually are broken?
Oh, I mean, that's the beauty of baseball. I mean, you know, when I was growing up, you know, you always had, and, you know, my dad was affiliated with the Yankees, and then when he was playing and things, you know, you had Babe Ruth. Nobody ever break the 60-run home run. And then I remember 1961 sitting there listening to the radio from New York as Maris and Mantle. Well, then Lou Gehrig, nobody can ever break his 2,160 consecutive games. And what was the back? It was in 1995. There we were watching Cal Ripken Jr. break the record. And, you know, remember when Lou Brock in the 70s was breaking Maury Wills' records for not only steals in a season, but then later on, a few years later, he was breaking the record for steals in a career. I mean, it just excites fans, and you want to be there. I mean, you know, everybody wants to be there.
The St. Louis Cardinals, Everything You Need to Know, book by Ed Wheatley. Ed, I do want to let you just tell some stories. I want you to talk about who you think some of the greats are. Mike Shannon, and, you know, people around here got to know him a little bit. You know.
For 50 years, you got to know him, right? First of all, I want to back up and talk about, you know why so many people know these great stories and, you know, fell in love with the Cardinals? The Cardinals had some of the premier announcers of baseball, you know, Harry Carey, Jack Buck, and then Mike Shannon. They were also the strongest radio station in the country. They were the most Western, the most Southern. You draw a triangle from St. Louis up to Washington, D.C., up to Boston and then over to Chicago. That triangle is all that baseball was. With the strongest signal, people would hear Cardinal baseball all through the South, all through the Southwest, and all the way up the Pacific. And they fell in love. And, you know, you had these men. And I always tell people, think about the announcers today. Harry Carey got his announcing gig telling the Cardinals they don't do it right. You need to have a picture painted for the listener. That's how they become fans. And you think about Harry Carey, his monologue was always the pitcher toes the rubber, looks in, gets the sign. Here's the windup, the stretch, the pitch. Sometimes it was, there she goes. It might be, it could be, but you could be sitting in your backyard and you're picturing that as though you were in the grandstands of Sportsman's Park. And that's how fans became. And especially, you know, we go back, Cardinals joined the National League in 1892. The National League was formed in 1876. There had been two previous attempts at a National League team in St. Louis that we talk about in the book, but they failed. But in 1892, the Cardinals came in, not as the Cardinals, but as the St. Louis Browns, and they stayed under that name until 1898 when they took the name Perfectos, and then the Cardinals when they changed their colors to that lovely shade of cardinal red. But you start through this history, as I spoke, all these decades of their dominance, you know, their pennants, and, you know, 26, 28, 30, 31, 34, 42, 43, 44, 46. And then you'll go into the 60s, the 80s, and the aughts. People always ask, well, what happened when they won in 42, 43, 40, 44 and then 46. Why didn't they win in 45? Well, they lost by a game and a half because Dan Mutual was in the Navy. What would have happened if Stan didn't go? I mean, you know, he is the greatest, without a doubt, his whole career with the Cardinals. I'm not taking a single thing away from Albert Pujols. It's just like your there's a nephew there about Yadi. This generation's here who got to see Albert in his career. Those first 11 years, what Albert did in baseball has never been replicated, not even by Ruth, Gehrig, Ty Cobb, Hank Aaron, Willie Mays. None of them have the first 11 years of the career. And then what he did for us last year, the last half of the season. I mean, Albert is on a pedestal. It's just too bad he didn't play his whole career here. But, you know, Stan did. But we have so many greats. You know, you talk about this radio broadcasting across the country. The Gas House Gang of the 30s, this rough and tumble, baggy, flanneled uniforms, always dirty of the Cardinals. You know, they loved – people loved them because during the Depression, when they were down and out, this was the team they could grab onto. I mean, in New York, it was the Yankees, of course, and their greatness, but they were in these storied white pinstriped uniforms, you know, big money, all of that. And the world fell in with the Gas House Gang, of led by Dizzy Dean, of all people, and his brother Daffy. Can you imagine what the neighbors thought when Mrs. Dean called Dizzy and Daffy in for dinner, screaming out there, "Hey, Dizzy, have Daffy come in." I mean, you know, what's with that house with those names? But, you know, you had Joe Medwick. You had Rogers Hornsby. These were all the greats of the early years of baseball. And, you know, so many of them played here in St. Louis. And it's because St. Louis, you know, they were winners. And, you know, Grover Cleveland Alexander, you talk about the moment in 1926, Game 7. He's already won Game 2. He's already run Game 6. And Alexander was known to maybe lift a bottle or two or three. And he was just sleeping it off down in the bullpen. And all of a sudden, the Yankees are coming back. They got the bases loaded. The Cardinals are winning 2-1. And it looks like, oh, my God, here come the Yankees. You know, they already won several pennants in World Series the previous years. But Grover Cleveland is called in by player manager Rogers Hornsby and says, get him. And one of the most notorious hitters in baseball. It's one of these, it's almost like a movie setup. Tony Lazzari comes in with the bases loaded, and after setting him up with this pitch and that pitch and that pitch, Lazzari hits a long fly ball foul just past the foul pole. And Alexander says, "I know what I was doing. I threw it inside. He's going to hit it foul, and I set him up, and he struck him out on the next pitch on an outside pitch." Cardinals win their first pennant. And there's so many stories like that, like, you know, the great Dizzy Dean of the 30s, and you know, Dizzy said he was the best pitcher who ever played baseball, and you don't know about him, you don't want to believe it, come watch me and I'll show you. I mean, you know, Dizzy was so great, yeah. He could have been greater, because if you were a fastball hitter, he threw you fastballs. If you're a curveball hitter, he threw you curveballs. He's going to show you he's better than you.
We watch the farm teams, and we see who's coming up, and we see who's getting traded, and we worry about these things. Less than a minute left.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Albert leaving and stuff like that, Yadi and Wainwright staying, you know, for their careers. And how hard is it going to be to have these people up on a pedestal when they only play for a team for 2 or 3 years?
Well, I think that's, you know, it's really changed. Like, you think of here in the Cardinals, some of these people have come and gone, or like all, you know, you don't remember and speak of the great Yankees or the great, you know, Giants when you had, you know, Ruth, Gehrig, DiMaggio, Mantle, all these guys whose full careers are there, you know. You know, the same way with Willie Mays, Willie McCovey in San Francisco, you know. And think about the statues in front of Busch Stadium, you know, all these great men whose whole career were here, or the Stan Musial statue where everybody, you know, comes to meet. How do you build a statue for a guy just 2 or 3 seasons, you know? It does, and it also impacts the loyalty of fans to a player, because some, you know, during those 10 years when I'd be speaking in schools and things, you know, when I'd say something about Yadi, everybody goes, "Yeah, Yadi." I'd say something about Pujols. "Oh, he's a traitor. You know, he went away, you know." That's how they take that, you know, and I just – so thankful Albert got to come back and remind people who he was and what he could do. But
well,
you made a good point.
We're out of time. This has been delightful. Right. Thank you. How can we get a copy of your book if we want to purchase it ourselves?
Okay. You can get it at any store, Barnes Noble, any of the brick-and-mortar bookstores. You can get it online. Just type in, you know, my last name or the St. Louis Cardinals, everything you need to know. Go to ReedyPress.com, which is the publisher. It is everywhere in all the stores throughout the whole Midwest region.
Well, I've already got people fighting to read it next, so it's a very good read. Thank you so much for the time you've given us today.
Well, thank you for having us.
Go Cardinals!
Yeah, we got to really go Cardinals.
Really go Cardinals.
Right?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.